Americans are in need of a 21st century vision of our country. Not a vision of movement, but one of place. Not one of tolerance, but one of belonging. Not simply of rights, but also of community. A community of equals.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum. Tonight we'll be discussing reimagining equality with Anita Hill, professor of social policy, law, and women's studies at Brandeis University. I'm Tricia Rose, Brown University professor, and I will be your moderator. In her new and amazing memoir, Reimagining Equality: Stories of Gender, Race, and Finding Home, Anita Hill takes the idea of home and explores how our family homes and our national home are linked to understandings of achievement, opportunity, and equality. The youngest of 13 children, Anita Hill grew up on a farm in rural Oklahoma. After receiving her JD from Yale University in 1980, she worked in private practice and for the federal government in Washington, D.C. Hill is the author of numerous professional articles on international commerce, commercial law, bankruptcy, and civil rights. Her book, Speaking Truth to Power, detailed her experience as a witness in Clarence Thomas's Supreme Court confirmation hearings. Please join me in welcoming to Cambridge Forum, Anita Hill.
Thank you. This is the launch day for the book. And so this is the first time I've given this talk. And I guess I'm a little anxious about it. Because this product is really something, reimagining equality is something that is very near to me. It is part memoir, but it is not entirely memoir. It shares with you not only my family story, but the stories of a number of women, past and present, and it attempts to bring us into a future conversation that will, I hope, impact generations to come. And so I'll begin. We are often referred to the United States as a nation of immigrants. So what does that mean? What it means to me is that as such, as a nation of immigrants, we are a population of seekers and descendants of seekers, people in search of home. For decades in our early history, we measured American progress in terms of movement and expansion. And even today, we gauge advancement toward the American dream by one's ability to seek out and secure a new, often bigger, and presumably better home in a different location from where they are now. Growing up in a stable community in rural Oklahoma, with my 12 siblings on a farm, I felt not so much like a seeker as a settler. I felt very settled in rural Oklahoma. And I even felt cheated out of ancestral participation in the pivotal movement toward progress that so many African Americans experience, known as the Great Migration. It was known for me as the Great Migration, in part, not just because there were a lot of people moving from south to north to west, but because of the great anticipation and the great expectations that came out of the movement. However, in researching Reimagining Equality, I learned that my family story involved movement as well. In doing so, and doing the research and understanding my own relationship with home, I came to appreciate not only the role that movement played, but also the role that those years of being settled on the farm in Oklahoma played in terms of the achievement of equality for me and my 12 siblings. Now, for those of you who are interested in research, and I hope some of you are doing your family history, I'll just say that I began the story, the chronicling of my family story, with a family legend. That was the start. Family legend had it that my grandparents left Arkansas and left behind a large working farm. And so the first question I asked myself to question where, how we got from Arkansas to Oklahoma and to understand the movement of my family was, how did my grandparents get a large farm in Arkansas? My grandfather, in fact, William Henry Elliott, was born in 1864. So he was born a slave. And I wanted to know how this child who was born a slave could ultimately come upon owning a large farm in Arkansas, given the times that he grew up in. But what I found when I researched the historical records was that, in fact, there were 80 acres that William Henry Elliott and my grandmother, Ida Crooks Elliott, homesteaded in 1895. And through the Bureau of Land Management, I was able to find the documentation of this homesteading. So indeed, the legend had truth to it. Although in looking at this documentation, I will tell you that I was thrilled to discover this documentation. I never knew my grandparents. And to find this documentation of their lives and their existence, to me, in a government record, was so compelling. And I felt as though I was probably looking at a document that had been tucked away since 1895 that no one had ever paid attention to. And for me, it was like discovery, a discovery of part of my past. I will say this, that I also discovered about that documentation. The deed itself had a number of entries, but nowhere in that documentation was my grandmother's name mentioned. She was not on the deed. The only way that she was referred to was in an applicant question, is the applicant married? And the answer was yes. There was also a referral there information in the document that said that the Elliots, Henry, took possession of the property in 1895, and a month later he had built on the property a two-room cabin where he, his unnamed wife, my grandmother, Ida Crooks Elliott, lived with their seven children. Now, it does seem a little cramped, but indeed it was, I am sure, better than the slave cabin in which he spent the first 10 years of his life. Acre by acre, the Elliots plowed and planted and cleared the land, which was covered with oak and pine trees. And within the 5 years of the homesteading period, they had tilled and farmed one quarter of the entire parcel. They planted an orchard, and as one observer noted, a fine orchard, one of the finest that he had ever seen, with fruit trees. And Ida Crooks Elliott filled the yard with flowers. And this was the farm that allowed my grandfather, Henry, to go from being property to owning property in about 50 years. Now, through Google Earth, I was able to get a bird's eye view of the property. And today it is once again overgrown with the oak and pine that was there when my grandparents found it. The trees hide its past farm, and even perhaps the past pain that my grandparents experienced there. So how did the family end up leaving this farm? It seems like really quite an idyllic situation. And in fact, perhaps it was in so many ways, it was such a great achievement that even generations later, my family members talk about it with great pride. But there is the other side of the story. And that is the legend that said that Henry Elliott left Arkansas with his family after he was threatened with a lynching. And I heard this story through the eyes of my Uncle George, my mother's brother, who was born in 1909. He was one of my primary sources. And he really, it was interesting because he was in his 80s when he told me the story, but he tells me the story of his family's journey to Oklahoma through the eyes of a child. He said, the day they got on the train, he was just so excited about being able to ride a train. This was the first time that he'd ever been on a train. But he also said the day that they left their farm was the first time he'd ever seen his father cry. Nevertheless, they did leave. And they left because, as a family legend has it, there was a lynching threat. Now, was this likely? Well, how was I to really document the threat? I couldn't be there, but what I could document was the atmosphere of racial violence that existed in Little River County, Arkansas, when my grandparents lived there. And I was able to do that through historians, one of whom, Richard Buckaloo, actually did a chronicling of the number of lynchings and the names of the lynch victims in Arkansas, county by county, year by year. And there were quite a few in the area which my grandparents lived. So the story of the lynching threat is likely, given the fact that it has endured all of these years, given the fact that my uncle saw my grandfather cry when he had to leave. I put all of those things together and say, I can't say with absolute certainty that this happened, but I can tell you that there's a great likelihood of it. But I also discovered some other factors that shaped Henry and Ida Elliott's ability to keep the home that they had obtained by right of law. I discovered one-sided debt agreements that my grandfather, Henry Elliott, had signed with former slaveholders, debt agreements that were there simply so that he could raise the crop to stay on the farm. And if you read them, it's amazing. They were so one-sided that mortgage holders actually had the right to decide and determine what the interest rate on the loans would be. I also learned crop prices during the early 1900s were spiraling down, particularly in cotton, which my grandfather grew. I learned of the hardship that my grandparents experienced as three of their 14 children died before they reached the age of 8 years old. Indeed, as I say, a number of factors shaped their ability to make a home in Little River County. Violence and official indifference to it, or even worse, suborning of it. Unavailability of credit or any kind of resources, financial resources, to help them earn a living. A failing agricultural economy and no other alternatives for uneducated farmers, particularly if they were black and female. So ultimately, Henry and Ida Elliott lost their home, and I leave to the reader to decide exactly how all of these factors came into play. But what they did was what Americans do. They moved. For the Elliots, they moved west to Oklahoma to search for a better life, if not for themselves, for their children, and soon to be born grandchildren. As I pieced together my grandparents' story, it sounded very eerily similar to some of the stories I read about today. The lack of credit, or bad credit, the loss of economic resources, the loss of homes, The heartbreak that I read in stories, in papers, in the newspapers today, in 2008 and, you know, throughout the last few years, really remind me so much of what took place in the early part of the 20th century. And as well, there are racial elements to the stories that are printed today. As we learn about the devastation in communities of color, the losses that African Americans, Asian Americans, and Hispanic Americans are suffering at the end of this recession, as many or as much as 65% of the wealth among Asian Americans and African American and Hispanic Americans has been lost in the last few years. And much of that has been tied to loss in the values of their homes. In Reimagining Equality, I explore the link between credit practices and the failing economies of my grandparents' time. I take you through the era of outright and hostile segregation, through an era of redlining, and throughout which women were consigned to secondary roles inside and outside the home. And I bring you to today, reverse redlining and targeting of women and people of color for subprime and high fee loans that occurred in the height of the subprime lending debacle. In doing so, I explore a number of ways that we learn about equality and think about equality. I look at popular culture. One of the things that I look at, and when sometimes people really can relate to this story, when I talk about how the role that the home has played in our thinking about what achievement is, and when people have finally made it. Remember the sitcom, The Jeffersons? How many of you remember the theme song to The Jeffersons? Ah, how could you forget it? So moving up to the east side to a deluxe apartment in the sky. Now that showed that you had made it. George Jefferson and Louise Jefferson, this African-American couple, had made it. And what did they do? Move up. And not only did they move up, but they didn't have to have beans burning on the grill anymore or fish frying. They had bought into a new way of life because they were now able to relocate and prove to the world that they had made it. So I look at popular culture, and I look at literature to help really illustrate not only the role that it plays, but that the home plays in our thinking about equality, but also our shared desire, the desire that we all have to find a home, whether it's we think of it as that place or a state of being. And one play that I think really is pivotal, at least in my growing up and understanding of the significance of home and the relationship that it played in the role of equality, is Lorraine Hansberry's A Raisin in the Sun. And for those of you who don't know it, briefly I will just say that it is a story of an African-American family who have come on to money. They have been living in cramped quarters in a tenement apartment in Chicago, and the mother, who lives in the apartment with her two adult children and a daughter-in-law and a grandson, wants to use that money to buy a home in the suburb. And she decides she's going to buy a home in the suburb of Chicago. Well, the suburb is a segregated suburb. And she beats with resistance in her effort to buy this home. And of course, in the end of Hansberry's play, we have a somewhat happy, if not cautious, conclusion, where ultimately the family moves into the suburb and the neighborhood is integrated. But I think Even though the white neighbor's resistance is prominent in the play is illuminating in a number of ways. It's illuminating not only about the desires of African Americans, but the desires of all Americans. And so in Reimagining Equality, I write, "A Raisin in the Sun illustrates not only how home became a repository for Black Americans' dream of finding a place in the nation, but also how it symbolizes all Americans' desire to belong. It is a story of race and gender and a universal experience of believing in a dream. Hansberry's is a cautionary tale revealing that a dream deferred doesn't just dry up like a raisin in the sun, but as Langston Hughes' poem suggests, instead could just explode. Moreover, the consequences of deferred dreams are not always immediate. They can extend decades into the future with consequences for generations to come. For over 50 years, Lorraine Hansberry's audience have focused on African Americans' clashes with the world outside their homes. Her ability to see into the future of conflicts inside the home is just as compelling. In the years since her play, I have come to fully appreciate how the two work together to enhance or to impede our chances at real equality." And so I look at Hansberry's play, and I see not only the tension that she is raising, the tension between African Americans and white Americans, but also it foretells of the tensions between women and men and how equality will be defined. What she signals is that that clash, unless we can resolve that clash within the home, unless we can resolve issues of gender equality, we will never be able to fully resolve the issues of racial equality. And so we moved forward. We moved through the 60s. We saw people of color, women of all colors, make strides in the 1970s and the 1980s. Yet we also saw rising materialism, increased violence inner cities, resistance to civil rights gains, and cultural backlash against women. And we also saw that the blueprint for the average American home was growing as well. Inside the home, changes were occurring as women of all races became part of the paid labor force. And so there were a mixture of factors, some gains and some losses. And there were also laws and policies that were, some were enforced and some were neglected. And if I could fast forward, what I would simply say is that all of those things came together to create the formula, I'll call it, for the subprime lending crisis. In many respects, the housing crisis came along and hit us hard. It hit communities of color, so much so that cities like Baltimore, Memphis, Tennessee, the state of Illinois, are suing Wells Fargo Bank for the devastation they allege that bank visited upon communities throughout their location. It was no accident that the foreclosure crisis occurred. Indeed, I suggest Hansberry forecasted, even though she didn't, of course, forecast the foreclosure crisis, none of us could have. So in Reimagining Equality, I do draw upon Hansberry's wisdom. And I look at the lives of contemporary African American women who are like the millions of Americans who are uncertain about their place, their home, for themselves and for their children. I look at their desires as universal desires, but I also look at them because their race and gender make their struggles unique. They are not simply looking for ownership. They are looking for a semblance of equality and authority, and that is being threatened by the foreclosure crisis and the housing market collapse. But I also want to say that I don't just leave you with the stories. I do tell you how it happened, and I offer ideas for how we, one, can prevent it happening again, and two, how we can make sure that what is happening now does not set back generations to come. And so I propose a number of ideas for how, in the wake of the foreclosure crisis, we can overcome the ravages of neglect and deliberate abusive practices. We can assure that the dream of finding home continues for these women and for their children and all of the children in America. Now, since the first African American in our history now occupies the White House, or calls the White House his home, it is fitting that I will begin with Barack Obama. Barack Obama, whose fervent search for home brought him to the presidency, must seize the moment of crisis to enlarge our concept of home for all Americans, but especially for the next generation. I would call, though, upon all leaders, all the nation's leaders, political and social, I would call upon all of you as well to take up this cause. Americans are in need of a 21st century vision of our country. Not a vision of movement, but one of place. Not one of tolerance, but one of belonging. Not simply of rights, but also of community. A community of equals. This new vision will lead to an inclusive American democracy that stays alive and remains real for everyone. And if you'll allow me one indulgence, a personal indulgence, I started talking this talk with a talk about my mother's family. And much of this book is inspired by my mother. And on October 16, 2011, I will celebrate the 100th birthday of my mother, Irma Hill. Now, she is not alive to celebrate with me. Nevertheless, I will celebrate. The place where I live with its long snowy winters, that would be here, is not likely what she contemplated 35 years ago when she sent me off with two sets of luggage. But it is my home, and each day I honor her by working to live up to her dream that I will find a more just America than the one she grew up in, and that as she did, I will leave that America better than how I found it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You've been listening to a program of Cambridge Forum recorded in October 2011, co-sponsored by the First Parish in Cambridge, the Lowell Institute, and the Friends of the Cambridge Forum.